I'm not suggesting that repression has lost its place as a fundamental defense mechanism. You know, repression remains central, coherent with the very fundamental, you know, the founding of the unconscious. It is what makes, you know, certain contents inaccessible to consciousness, and what we access as psychoanalysts through dreams, play, symptoms, association, that remains true. What I was observing, and I'm still observing more now, is something different. As you said, when I see children and adolescents, that they are more capable to do that, you know, working on a task, well, a homework, and at the same time, listening to music, and at the same time, chatting with somebody. I don't think that they are real. This is my point. I don't think they are real. This is a multitasking, you know, way of living that it's part of, you know, life today. The clinical questions for us becomes this. When does this multiplicity become a symptom? When does it interfere with the capacity for depth, for intimacy, for a sustained emotional contact? And I think that this is what we need to see, to study, and to differentiate in our consulting rooms.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Virginia Unger. We will be discussing today a paper she wrote entitled The Toolbox of the Analyst Trade, Interpretation Revisited. And it's in particular the revisiting that she graciously allows us to get to know. That is, she shares with us the way she intervened and the way she understood the best way to intervene with her patients 40 years ago, and what she's learned over the years, and how she intervenes now. And she gives us actual clinical exchanges to make these evolutions clear to us. It isn't often that clinicians will do that. Dr. Unger is a training analyst at the Buenos Aires Psychoanalytic Association. She is the former president of the International Psychoanalytic Association. She specializes in child and adolescent analysis, was the chair of the IPA's Child and Adolescent Psychoanalysis Committee, and was awarded the Konex of Platinum Award in 2016. We review some of the cultural changes that have taken place over these decades and engage the question, how might they impact how we understand the mind and how we intervene in the mind for the benefit and evolution of the patient? As always, I learned something when speaking with Virginia, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with her. Here is my chat with Dr. Virginia Unger. Vir- Virginia, welcome back to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you. There have been a number of conversations that we've had on this podcast about the changing character of our culture and wondering what impact it may be having on our clinical work. For example, and this is what people talk about all the time nowadays, the availability of the internet and now AI obviously impacts the rhythm of learning, of curiosity, and indeed of time itself. Also, sexuality is more available in its hyper-stimulating, anonymous versions. And in addition, if not related to that, the nuclear family, for many, has been dramatically transformed. So the question is, how might this impact the intrapsychic space, not just the cultural space? Many have observed, and again, this is something you and I are going to discuss from your paper, a lessening of the paternal symbolizing function. And associated with that is a relative absence of cultural rites of passage. Again, we will discuss this. And while repression remains a backbone of a defensive structure for all of us, more and less, you also note that there's been an increase in splitting and dissociation as a core defensive style. We're going to take each of these issues up, but what's so special about your paper, and again, the title is The Toolbox of the Analyst's Trade, Interpretation Revisited, is that after reviewing these cultural and intrapsychic evolutions, you present process material of your own, separated by 40 years. Material documenting how you intervened with a five-year-old boy who came to you for stuttering, and many years later, how you worked in a very different way with an analytic patient. We will get to that at the end. To start us off, from the early part of your paper, you write, "Perhaps we may consider psychoanalytic clinical practice as a device consisting of a series of heterogeneous elements which, like any device, comes into being in relation to a situation of urgency, or at least a new situation. In our case, furthermore, a situation linked to suffering, which changes and transforms, as does subjectivity. In regard to these variations, what consequences do they have for our psychoanalytic device?" Virginia, thoughts?
Yes, thank you, Harvey. I'm also happy to be back here in a conversation with you about psychoanalysis. I think our common passion. And yes, so let's go to your question. I think that when I wrote these papers, I was trying to name something many of us were beginning to feel, but hadn't feel fully articulated, that our device, the psychoanalytic setting, its tools, its logic, was being, in a way, quietly, by insistently pressured by changes in subjectivity we could no longer ignore. I think that we are now, some years later, I think that the question hasn't changed. But I have to tell you that I think that the weight of it has changed. Because, as you mentioned, the digital world, you know, when I wrote that paper, it was already present in our consulting rooms. But in many ways, it was the beginning, the threshold. Today, I think that the digital world, and later I would like to speak about this regarding a congress we are organizing for next year. But today, the digital world, I think it's inside the session, at some points inside the transference relationship, inside the way our patients dream about how they suffer, and how do they relate to the technological world. After the publishing of that article, came the pandemic, you remember, that forced us overnight to reinvent the setting that we had taken for granted. You remember that suddenly the couch, the silence, the shared physical space, everything what we had assumed was simply, you know, what we call the frame, then we had choices. We had to make our own choices. So the tools, it was in a way the, you know, the proof that tools can be questioned. Now what strikes me returning to that text is how much still holds. In a way, we could say that the conviction, I think that I had, or we had, that psychoanalysis was a kind of monument. It's not true. It's a monument in a way, but a living practice. And we must respond to what is genuinely new without losing what is genuinely its own. To tell you a simple example, the hammer hasn't changed, but the house we are asked to build looks quite different. And in that way, I think that we must return again and again to our toolbox, not to find answers, but I think it helps returning to our toolbox. I think that allows us to ask ourselves better questions.
Let me I don't ask know you if something. I answered that. No, that's very helpful. But you say the digital world is inside the session, inside the transference, inside the dream. What does that look like? I never would have thought those words, and I'm interested that you did. How does one know when the digital world is inside all those things as opposed to the old-fashioned way?
Yes, I'm not referring to concrete material things. You know, my cell phone and the patient's cell phone is turned off. It's turned off. Mm-hmm. Sometimes with a kid or a young adolescent who wants to show you something, what his or her boyfriend or girlfriend wrote, the song he or she needs you to listen. Mm-hmm. But with adult patients, you know, I don't like to say it invades. It is part of our world today. You know, there okay. are dreams mm-hmm. that show, there are dreams, there are, you know, associations, and there are some, you know, practical things in the setting that I can mention them, but I don't think this is important. What I think, you know, the use of WhatsApp here in Buenos Aires, for example, nothing happens with the landline.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't work anymore. Everything is on WhatsApp. I'm late. Could you change the session? I'm late. I cannot be, you know, with you in the consulting room. Could we go online? And these kind of things are everyday, almost everyday things. I think that the way we relate to the others is in a way, is in the content of the dreams, in the relationship with the analyst. And I could give you some examples, but I think that it's part of our everyday world, we like it or not.
Certainly agreed. Back when I was in training, the idea, well before cell phones, the idea that one would have a phone conversation with a patient between a session was either unheard of or require endless discussion, but discussion with a particular judgmental point of view. It's not let's discuss, let's learn what this contained and what it meant. That was the cover, and it was really, and this shouldn't be happening. And how one manages that nowadays, for us, it's not WhatsApp so much here in the States. It's texting, but it's the same point. What happens inside the session and what happens outside the session and what the meaning is to each of the parties is something that we all have to learn how to manage, because it is part of daily life and clinical life. Let me read what you wrote about some of the historical changes. I made mention to it in the introduction, but you write it much more beautifully here. You say, when we come to examine the most diverse historical situations, we see that each society constructs rites of passage to accompany threshold situations such as birth, death, and/or marriage. You go on to say that contemporary society does not provide institutionalized rites of initiation. The rituals of the modern day, and this is to me your important point, created by the young people themselves, and strikingly similar across different parts of the Western world, are more comparable to the tests of bravery, which pepper our nursery tales. They may consist of kissing someone who they have just met, not necessarily of a different gender, taking alcohol until they pass out, smoking marijuana, or ingesting other substances, amongst other things. Bound up with these variations, another trend acquires a significant presence in the space of psychoanalytic discussion. And this has come to be known as the demise or the decline of what we know as the paternal function. Now, you say a lot in this, and we're going to get to it, especially as you write about how it applies to the adolescent. But your point that these rituals are created by young people themselves, tell me more about how you see that as so essential.
Yes. First of all, I was always interested in anthropology. Before I entered medical school, I took a course. I went to university to study anthropology. Then I discovered that I wanted to become an analyst. And that days you need to be an MD. So I went to the School of Medicine. So anthropology is still one of my favorite readings. But, you know, anthropologists know very well about this, you know, that every society, every culture constructed rites of passage to accompany life thresholds as birth, death, marriage, and the transition from childhood to adulthood. And these rituals, you know, were not, in a way, they were not arbitrary. They certified a change of status and inscribed it in, you know, the group symbolic fabric. So nowadays, and I think this is important, because when I wrote the article, I think it was, you know, the adolescents were in my mind. But today I think it's the same, because adolescents are, you know, the target, not only because every adult wants to be an adolescent again, and every little girl or boy wants to become an adolescent. You can see this nowadays, you know, when little girls, you know, deal with makeup on TikTok, just the digital, for example.
Right.
On TikTok, they learn to, you know, their routine with, you know, with the skin and the almost everybody wants to become an adolescent. And adolescents are the target of the experts in marketing. So
yeah.
I think that, and a third thing that I think is most important, that, you know, that great or big changes in society, in culture, and in history were led by adolescents. And I don't need to mention you, but it was true. So I think that I like to study adolescents, and I like to try to understand. So what happens when the contemporary society and the contemporary culture no longer provides those, in a way, institutionalized rites of initiation? I don't need to describe what's going on in the world now. There is no time to.
But you make the case very similar to religious leaders, because what you've said is what leaders of religion and across the board religions who they call for a return to traditional rites of passage, to return to hierarchical structures, to the deities of various religions are generally infused with maleness, offering the structure that you're saying is missing often for the paternal function. How does that match up with what you're saying?
I think that it coincides because we can see that religions are growing up, and mostly, very orthodox religions. And I'm referring to religions in general.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I think that it has to do with something that culture doesn't provide anymore. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So young people, adolescents, early adolescents, pubertal kids, they are confused and they look for something that could give them containment. And in a way, the rites of passage had this, function. Nowadays, only religious, associations or religion can offer this. But children who are not religious and their family are not religious and they are not attracted by religions, they have, in a way, the obligation of creating, a symbolic obligation of creating their own rites of passage. Mm-hmm. And they are not so, I don't like to say good or bad, but they are not, they have to have sex, even in public. We all know, they have to drink until they passed out, and to have to take substances, and they have to, to drive in a very speed, putting themselves in risk. And I think that it has to do with, from my point of view, with the declination of the paternal function. The French analysts describe this better, but I think that we are witnessing that this is happening in our culture. It doesn't mean it's bad, but it means that now...
Doesn't mean it's good.
We speak of... I think that it's good because now it has to do, with the configuration of the classical family, that, it was the type of family that used to be when Freud discovered, psychoanalysis, the unconscious. The man had a central role, not only in private, but in public spaces as well. And now everything changed. So I don't think it's bad. It's something that is happening because of the change of the role of the woman. And I prefer... Instead of paternal function or maternal function, nowadays I speak about parental function.
So you're really underlining the importance of the generational hierarchy rather than the maternal and paternal. Is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
Okay. I get that.
Yes, but we have to be aware that everything changed because, in the past, the grandfather, the eldest of the tribe, was the one who transmitted knowledge. And nowadays, there is a kind of cognitive, revolution. Our children and our grandkids teach us how to deal with the digital world. So we have to take into account all these factors.
Let me read what you've written about adolescence. You say, I seek to highlight some of the variations in subjectivity in general and in the adolescent in particular, which have implications for psychoanalytic clinical practice and which require us to overhaul our toolbox. You go on to say that my impression is that the mental mechanisms used by children, adolescents, and technology conversant adults are closer to those related to splitting than to repression. It is not that I think that repression is not used, but the type of media interaction by means of which a young person can be simultaneously watching television, instant messaging, watching a YouTube clip, and sending an SMS seems to me to be analyzable in terms of splitting and dissociation of various levels of the self, allowing him or her to focus, or perhaps unfocus, attention upon multiple things at the same time. Now, I think everybody listening to that will smile in recognition, and you don't have to be a child or an adolescent to be familiar with that phenomena of us all being distracted. It occurs to me that when I do that and when I see people around me doing that, yes, clearly we are not focused on one or the other, and we are diffused. We are, as a form of dissociation, maybe with a small d, but maybe more so I hear it in the office. When people live their lives like that, it seems that they're also under the influence of repression. They are not letting themselves become aware of their imagination, their own desires, their own creativity, their own object attachments and fantasies. It's all being broken down and split up into little pieces. And one needs to get to that which is being forbidden by doing so, which is under, again, the power of repression, for it to really develop an alternative. Does that match your sense of things?
Yes, yes, absolutely. But I want to be careful here. I am careful here because I'm not suggesting that repression has lost its place as a fundamental defense mechanism. You know, repression remains central, coherent with the very fundamental, you know, the founding of the unconscious. It is what makes, you know, certain contents inaccessible to consciousness. And what we access as psychoanalysts through dreams, play, symptoms, association, that remains true. What I was observing, and I'm still observing more now, is something different. As you said, when I see children and adolescents that they are more capable to do that, you know, working on a task, well, a homework, and at the same time, listening to music, and at the same time, chatting with somebody, I don't think that they are ill. This is my point. I don't think they are ill. This is a multitasking, you know, way of living that it's part of, you know, life today. What I think about that, I don't know. I was thinking about this and I, you know, and I went to the kind of metaphor that came from physics and astronomy, the multiverse. And there was a beautiful movie that showed that. This is the idea that, you know, possible different universes can coexist simultaneously, each with its own laws and constants. So I needed to think in other fields because I wanted to understand what's going on. But I think that as analysts, we can speak of several, you know, aspects of the self. And I was raised, I'm still, you know, a Kleinian, so we can speak about different parts of the self held together, sometimes held apart by splitting. But this, what I wanted to say is that splitting is not a catastrophic defense necessarily. It's a mode of organizing a complex, over-simulated mental reality. So then I think that the clinical questions for us becomes this. When does this multiplicity become a symptom? When does it interfere with the capacity for depth, for intimacy, for a sustained emotional contact? And I think that this is what we need to see, to study, and to differentiate in our consulting rooms. Is this clear?
Oh, it's not only clear, it's beautifully put. And you say it in the paper also beautifully and succinctly. You have a sentence there I have this tendency to choose favorite sentences in papers. I don't know why. And this jumped out as my favorite sentence. And you write, intimacy has become spectacle. And that we could spend a whole podcast on that. You go on to say, I believe that although privacy is invaded by the media, there is a space for intimacy that can be nurtured and preserved. This is a mental space that affords an individual the possibility to make contact with an area of the mind through which emotional relationships and creativity in its entire dimension pass. In our time, for some people, the analytic session represents their only space for privacy, and it is here where the construction of the notion of intimacy may begin. It is here where the construction of the notion of intimacy may begin. You know, I have this idea about how an analytic treatment, when it goes well, is a gift. And it's a gift in many, many ways. But this so captures one aspect of this gift, where the construction of the notion of intimacy may begin.
Yes, because when I wrote this, the text we are discussing now, I was, that intimacy became a spectacle. And this is a title of a book, and an Argentinian anthropologist who lives in Rio de Janeiro, she published a book. And I think that this captured something, that social networks and media have turned private experience into performance. Where that self-esteem, so important for adolescents, is measured in likes and followers. I would like to tell you an anecdote. A couple of years later than the time when I wrote the paper, I was invited by the Australian Association of Psychoanalysis to spend a week working with them when they organized the annual meeting. And it was hard work, but I enjoyed it a lot. And I had some free hours. It's unusual, but I want to go for a walk. And okay, it's okay. If you are back in 2-3 hours, it's okay. So I asked where I could find a museum, walking distance, and they said, there is a museum of contemporary art 3 blocks from here. So I went to the museum of contemporary art, beautiful, not too big, the size of museum that I like. I visited some rooms. Then I entered the room, a quite big room, and there were, very beautiful things on a kind of place, beautiful things in golden, and they were very well illuminated, and there was an empty chair, and there was the light, cenital light was there, and suddenly a young couple appeared. They were dressed in a very old way, 17, 18 era, and they came to me, and the girl, beautiful, she said, "Do you mind if I offer a song to you?" And I felt a little bit, moved, and she had to repeat, "Do you mind if I offer you a song?" "Oh no, thank you." And she, showed me the chair with the light, and I sat down, and she started to sing in German. I don't understand German, even one word. But, during the time she sang for me, the only thing that existed in that room was this woman, young woman, singing beautifully a Schubert lead. I understood this. So they finished, they say thank you, and I say thank you, and they left. And there were people around us, people circulating, not paying attention to what happened. And when I went out of the room, you know, there were the signs were explained that there was an installation by a Taiwanese artist named Li Mingwei. And what the story that was told there is that this is the lied that his mother sang when he was a very, very uneasy boy. He was difficult, you know, behavior. So the way she calmed down him was singing this song. And many years later, he sang this lied to his mother when she was operated on her heart in a very, very complicated surgery. So, Harvey, this was something that taught me, and I presented a paper on that in one congress on intimacy, that intimacy has nothing to do with walls, with the geographical limits, you know, of walls, doors. It's a dynamic, and, you know, every time it's rebuilt and created. And I think that even in our hyper-connected world, there is always something of the self that has to be hidden, remains hidden. And I think that, as you said, this was, you know, my experience that taught me what intimacy could mean apart from the images we have, doors, windows, walls. Has little to do with that. That's why I think, and maybe I will be a little hard, but I think that psychoanalysis is a kind of space of resistance for intimacy. Because I think that nowadays, even more, for some patients, you have to, you know, to help them to rebuild a space of intimacy. But for others, it has no notion. Some of them, they have no notion of what intimacy means. And I think intimacy is at the core of our analytic practice.
That's quite a statement.
Yes.
Let me, again, I'm tempted to spend time with each of these stations that we stop at, but I want to make sure that we have time to get to the clinical material. And I want to introduce it.
I'll get us there.
You write in anticipation of presenting these two cases, you write that I postulated in the year 2000 a different interpretive modality may be deduced, one that is based, in my view, more on the possibility of observing and describing than of explaining. From my perspective, this interpretive modality also metacommunicates an attitude of observation, reflection, and conjecture. With that, you start us off with a brief vignette of a treatment you did now, you say, 40 years ago. And the subject is a five-year-old boy who was treated for an intense stutter and impairment in the standard of graphic ability expected for his age, and he was treated four times a week. And you write, he arrives and has little difficulty parting from his mother who brought him there. He comes to eating fizzy sweets that make a noise in his mouth. He opens his mouth and says to me, "Look at how they explode." I take a look. He begins to speak at great speed in a high-pitched tone. He stutters a lot, and he coughs and sneezes. He tells me that he was given a bicycle as a gift and that at a barbecue the day before, my parents ate outside. I make an interpretation. I say, as this is the first session, you are frightened. You may want to fill everything with words because inside you, you have ideas that you feel are things that are exploding in your mouth like the sweets. The boy adds, they're exploding in my mouth like bombs. I interpret. I say, you are scared of me. You don't know how I'm going to receive what you feel are bombs inside of you. The boy says, tell me, what am I here for? Oh, yes, I came here for you to tell me that I have to come. But I play basketball and today I missed it. I make an interpretation. I say, on the one side, you would like to find out with me why the words are exploding in your mouth and they get cut off and you stutter. But on the other hand, you are afraid and you would prefer to stick with what you know, which is basketball. And you reflect on this exchange by saying, my reading of the interpretations I made to him in the first session, I agree with the content of them. At the same time, I find the formulation very assertive. It confers meaning, but does not open up pathways. Instead, it presents hypotheses that hardly leave room for any other new ideas. Share with us what you recall about that experience all those years ago, which you say you were a young analyst at the time. And we've all been young analysts, and we can all look back, but rarely yes. with this honesty, Virginia. So help us out.
You know what happened? I was trying to find a material to, you know, to publish and regarding, you know, that paper, and I was trying to find material from supervisions. And then at one point I said, no, I will take myself and I will try to see how it was, how it could be. And I still am a child analyst, and this, you know, taught me a lot. But I think it was a revealing exercise for me. I still agree, you know, Harvey, even 10 or 12 years later, with the content of my interpretation. And I said this in the article because I pointed to what Melanie Klein taught us, you know, to go to the point of maximum anxiety. But I still, now I think that the formulation was very assertive, in a way closing down, you know, possible paths than opening up. Today, what I said, and I still say, I would pause, I would stay closer to Andres, let him arrive at things himself with my help, but coming from him. I think that what changed 30 and 40 years ago was what changed my way of working in analysis was the encounter with Donald Meltzer. It's because I had supervisions with him and I took courses and I knew him. So, you know, and there is at some other time we could discuss this, that he proposed the aesthetic conflict, that we cannot achieve and know everything, that the object is not transparent, that there is a mystery that we have to respect. And then I think that then it came from there, you know, a different style of interpretation, because the whole article has to do with interpretation. I think that it was like that when I wrote the article, but nowadays the picture is more complex. This is what I think now, because children come to us speaking a language shaped by social media and online games. You know, children spend hours in a virtual world that has its own rules and logic. And this is the material they bring, impregnated by, you know, the social media language. And I think that we don't need to know everything, but we need to know something about the world they inhabited, in some way understand their codes, and with the attitude of not idealizing and not pathologizing it, trying to understand. And I think that there are, you know, the essence is unchanged, because when we are with a kid, a psychoanalyst, we think, can this child symbolize? Is he or she able to play? Because play is still the road to the unconscious, like in adults. But I think that also the families had changed profoundly. So I still think that the content was okay. If I analyze myself. I supervise myself. I say it's okay. But today I would be more cautious, waiting a little bit more. That's why I said that I was a young analyst. Yeah.
We have an example of your more current way of thinking. But let me ask you, I read that first example of you're basically telling him what he was feeling as my understanding, and this is my limitation perhaps, of a Kleinian approach. Now, you sort of say it was a Kleinian approach. Is it still a Kleinian approach? Is that still how what people who call themselves Kleinian would operate?
I will say that it is a Kleinian approach to go to the maximum point of anxiety, to relate what's going on him at the first encounter with an analyst, the persecutory anxiety. I can tell you the hostility, aggression, that was the problem, the center problem of this kid, because what sure. I interpreted it was a little, you know, I dare to interpret that his hostility or the bombs coming inside him were cutting his words. That's why I also interpreted right. the symptom. This is for the first session. Nowadays, I think I was very enthusiastic. I still defend what I said and my way of thinking and interpreting. But today, I would be more cautious, waiting a little bit more. This is the difference.
And the clinical proof is that this was a treatment that went on for a number of years and in many ways very successfully. So that's really the measure of the value of whatever theory we bring to it.
Yeah.
You go on and now you present material from decades later and you say, a young patient during the course of her fourth year of analysis and recently starting a Monday session informs me with great excitement and in a questioning tone that she has decided to invite me to her university graduation ceremony, which will take place within the next 2 months. Then she remains silent. I do not respond with anything. Neither do I feel the need to do so. After a time, she continues to talk about how difficult it was for her to come to the decision to invite me, but she feels that my presence will be important to her, that it would never have entered into her head to invite me to a party, her birthday, for example, but that this is different. She falls silent again for several minutes. She then says that she was talking to her boyfriend and they felt sure that I would not want to go because that would be going outside of the setting. Another silence, this time more lengthy. And she says that, thinking it over, perhaps I will not want to go because I think that I might make her more anxious. Mm-hmm. Now, you comment at this point to the reader that over half the session has already transpired during the course of what you just described. You then say, and then I interpret that perhaps she needed my concrete presence at her graduation ceremony because she did not trust relying on me from inside herself. Following this, she reached the conclusion herself, firstly, that I would not go because I am bound to the rules of the setting, to then consider that perhaps I would not go in order to look after her analysis, and therefore her. The session continued and the climate of relief the patient felt was evident. Shortly afterwards, she told me that now she thought that perhaps she felt obliged to invite me because of something connected to her own feeling of exclusion in different groups since she was a child. And then you say the transference situation opened up and she began describing memories, including the birth of her brother and other feelings of exclusion that this was designed to remedy. I'm going to ask you about this exchange in a moment, but you do note that one difference is you write that now I use my countertransference as an indicator, as I did not feel any pressure or necessity on my part to intervene. So share with us what a profound different experience it was for you and undoubtedly for your analyst aunt.
Yes, when I listen to you and if I reread the session, I think that I would redouble my commitment to that position. Yes, speaking less, waiting, and above all, listening and observing. I think that the vignette shows that the analyst and the patients are together, constituting at some point the device. Because the analyst brings an analyzed mind, that this is why it is very important training analysis that Freud recommended, indicated, and it's what we do. But, you know, being an analyst doesn't mean that we are the possessors of meaning. You know, we, in a way, let's say in a very, ordinary way, we don't carry the interpretation in our pockets. We don't have it. We have, you know, to create meaning together with the patient. We accompany the analytic process, and in some sense, we conduct it, but we are not in a position of power over it. And I think this is a very sensitive, now I'm saying this, it is a very sensitive concept or issue, power. Okay, you know that I was elected president in 2015. I was the IPA president for 4 years, and I learned things that I never, you know, put my attention, and I had to study, and I had to learn about politics, power, and power is something that could be part of the transference situation, and we have to be very careful not to exercise power. Power is not a thing that you can have, grab and have. It is constructed with consensus, and it has, maybe someday we could talk about this, but the analyst who believes that possesses the meaning, and then he or she will interpret in a, you know, in a position of certainty, is exercising a kind of power that, in my way, closes down the very process, you know, that we are trying to open up. So
your statement, it's you create meaning with the patient, that you do it together. You each learn and bounce off. It's you're writing music together and you're improvising.
You're writing music together. You are in a different position. There is some asymmetry. I understand that, and I assume that.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Because as an analyst, I have an analyzed mind, for sure. But we have to listen, to observe, and to create meaning together. And I think it is very important. It has to do not only with politics in institutions, in countries, everywhere, but also in the analytic session. This is the way I think now.
You summarize that in two sentences. Can I ask you to read that? It's the next to the last paragraph of the paper.
Okay. Today, I see myself as interpreting closer to the patient and to his or her state of mind. I see a joint task. This is an invitation to a process of thinking that, to remain alive, must be rethought.
And that's the spirit that radiates from you, Virginia. Yeah, it's an invitation that we are inviting patients. You know, we all have these phrases. For me, that it's a gift. You're describing that it's an invitation to a process, that it's a place of intimacy. We're all sort of like blind people and the elephant trying to describe this remarkable entity of the psychoanalytic process. And we're all right and we're all incomplete and we all struggle to give meaning and names to it. But when it does work, it doesn't always work, but when it does work, it really is a remarkable enterprise. And you mentioned your time back at the IPA president. You, I'm sure, remember as I do that when you were president, you and I, speaking about creating something together, you and I got together and I said, why don't we do a podcast? And you were all for it. And you encouraged it, and we went to the board together, and they were supportive of it, and it's grown to this this special thing. So, Virginia, we will continue to meet and talk and follow your learning and your wisdom that's gathered over the years. You said you wanted to make a comment about the IPA meeting that you are chair of, the program committee. A plug for the meeting, which is July 27. Why don't you make the plug?
Yes, please, because thank you. First of all, thank you for, you know, giving me the opportunity to have a conversation with you. It's not the first, and I hope won't be the last, because it's very inspiring. And let me tell you that we, in a way, we brought this example to the organization of the next IPA Congress in Vancouver, July 2027. Because instead of organizing, you know, keynote papers and discussions, we will organize conversations between psychoanalysts and also between analysts and experts in the fields like anthropology, philosophy, arts. And of course, I will invite all people who will listen to this podcast to pay attention to the Congress, to organize submissions, and to go to Vancouver, because it's one of the most beautiful cities I saw in my life.
I'm looking forward to it. Virginia, as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Bye.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.